How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF. Coming up on this week's episode of Sustainable Futures, we focus on youth and sustainability. Derek Corrigan, Mayor of Burnaby, speaks about public transit, civic politics, and youth involvement in the second of a two-part feature.
I really think that the government would have to listen, that some of the young people who are going to inherit the world would stand up and say, this is wrong, this is fundamentally wrong.
And we're in conversation with Maya Green, the director of a unique, new, sustainably focused educational summer camp for kids called Fun Camps, Friends Uniting for Nature.
Some of the stories I see of what youth are doing for the environment is just so unbelievably inspiring.
And we have your weekly environmental news update and thoughts from the street.
I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And you're listening to Sustainable Futures. I'm really excited about this show. It's a very important topic, considering that the youth are the people that get to inherit the mess that we made. I like having a show that focuses on it. I think this was a really good idea, Kim.
Yeah, I think it was a good idea as well. I think that it's important. I mean, obviously, the youth are the future, and they have a lot of amazing things to say, and they also have a lot of energy that when you focus it on, you know, something like sustainability and solving the problems that we have in the world today, they can do a lot with that. Youth are just great.
There's optimism that comes from youth, I think. They haven't been taught so many things as we have that are negative, I think, because I think the generation we're in, we're sort of in a transitional generation where we grew up without the same kind of awareness, and we were part of the problem until we started to learn that it was a problem, and then now we're trying to change, whereas youth can start with good habits. Rather than having to change their habits, they can start with them. And I think that is actually the key here.
They have a lot of great things to say and a lot of energy, and I think that it's important to get more youth involved in the sustainability movement.
So the feature interview is with Mayor Derek Corrigan, Mayor of Burnaby. This is a second installment of a series. Last week we had him talking about the city of Burnaby and its sustainability initiatives. And this week, it's more focused on issues that are a little bit broader than just Burnaby. And one thing that I discovered in the interview is that he is very, very passionate about youth involvement.
Here is the second installment of our interview with Derek Corrigan.
How does council feel about the Gateway Plan, and how does the Gateway affect Burnaby?
You've heard the kind of positiveness and optimism that I've had in most of my discussion with you, and I am optimistic about the future of our region and optimistic about what we can achieve together, even against the obstacles that we've got, you know, and there are many obstacles as the world is changing. But there are some decisions that are made that are simply crass political decisions, that are decisions that are made outside the context of the rest of the things that we're doing. And the Gateway Project, the twinning of the Portman Bridge and the widening of the highway, are exactly that kind of decision. The provincial government is looking at the potential to get votes in the Fraser Valley from people who are commuters. There are people who are frustrated sitting, waiting for traffic at the Portman Bridge. Mm-hmm. And the provincial government sees it to be in their interest to get all those votes that are sitting in that car by promising them there's a magic solution to the problem that they're facing. Unfortunately, what people think is going to solve their problem isn't going to solve their problem. Is that if anything, they'll have a very temporary respite, and then it will only get worse. In the meantime, they're going to make a choice of spending billions of dollars of their money in order to widen highways and build bridges. And they should know. And we should be educating them to the fact that none of this will make a difference in the end result.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look at Seattle. I mean, anybody who hasn't driven down to Seattle should drive down to Seattle and see how highways make a difference. Because Seattle has taken the center of their city and inundated it with highways. And the traffic jam continues, severe traffic jams. You cannot move in Seattle at rush hour. And yet they've spent billions of dollars on roads and highways. They are now moving to transit because they can't accommodate the kind of vehicles that they've got and the kind of growth they've gotten into their suburban and rural areas. There is no way that twinning the Portman Bridge and creating more highway space is going to do anything more but create environmental damage in our community, encourage more single-family growth in the Fraser Valley against the agricultural land reserve and green space and against our environmental values. Ironically, much of the pollution they're going to produce is going to go down the valley into their own homes.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a situation where in Burnaby directly, as I told you earlier, it's a funnel. As we get to the small end of the funnel, the traffic starts to back up. There aren't highways going into Vancouver, so right. The traffic backs up. Willington is right now the highest crash location in BC.
Okay.
As a result of people trying to get off the highway and find a way through our city. By widening the highway, we're going to take that traffic jam and move it back to Spurling or to Gillardy.
Uh-huh.
We're going to end up in a situation where that traffic that's idling is going to create more pollution.
Yeah.
It's going to affect Burnaby Lake and Deer Lake and the Simon Fraser Conservation Area. It works directly against the choices that we've made to encourage transit with the U-Pass and decisions that students are making to use transit as opposed to a single occupant vehicle. And out of it, there will be no good accomplished. Is that even if they have a brief period of time when traffic improves, within 5 years, the traffic will be at the same level. The only problem is there will be increased pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're opposed, adamantly opposed to the Gateway Project, the twinning of the Portman and the widening of the highway. We don't believe that this is anything but crass politics by the provincial government to try to get votes. It is completely contrary to their goal of achieving a reduction in greenhouse gases. It's so hypocritical as to be unconscionable. And I'm amazed that there hasn't been a stronger reaction from our student population. You know, as I said, I really think that the government would have to listen if some of the young people who are going to inherit the world would stand up and say, this is wrong. This is fundamentally wrong. We're the people who are going to live with the decisions that are being made at this time. And making this bad decision is only going to make it more difficult for us in the future. Spend those billions of dollars not on roads, but on transportation improvements, because that's the reality of our future.
And I came across something that said that the city of Burnaby is actually putting media out about Gateway that's opposed to it. Is this true?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're preparing a very significant piece of literature to go out and deal with what we know to be false information provided by the provincial government. They are a PR machine, and what they do is they try to push around and intimidate the municipalities. Metro Vancouver voted against Gateway. Metro Vancouver is the organization representing all of the cities. Metro Vancouver voted against Gateway.
Wow, that's quite significant.
And they've ignored it. In fact, they say that because we vote against it, we're dysfunctional and we should be done away with, you know, because we voted against it, which is really the attitude of this. It astounds me that they can talk out of both sides of their mouth and that somehow the media continues to pat them on the back and say what wonderful guys they are. Well, you can't be claiming you're going to reduce greenhouse emissions by a third and then proceed to build more highways and more bridges. I mean, the hypocrisy of it is absolutely unbelievable. And we do need, and I say this again, we need young people, particularly students at university, to get up off their butts and to go out and start fighting against this decision. This is probably one of the more critical choices that are being made for the Lower Mainland. in our lifetimes. You know, in the 1970s, there was a proposal to put a highway through Vancouver into the downtown core. And the community stood up and opposed it vehemently and defeated it. Is that that decision would have destroyed Vancouver. And the community reaction that opposed and stopped it is what has given Vancouver its livability. And the same thing is happening here in our community, is to take, you'll have 15 lanes of highway at Wellington. Imagine, right through the center of our city, 15 lanes of highway. And the traffic will impose itself on every community in our city. It is going to be virtually impossible for people to move around. Our infrastructure can't take it. Meanwhile, though, we continue to grow into the Fraser Valley, putting more pressure on the agricultural land, because in the valley, there are going to be developers saying, we need more single-family lots out here. We can sell that property for $500,000, $600,000, $800,000 a lot. If I change this from agricultural land to single-family residential, and I've got people that are lined up waiting to buy it, and they want a three-car garage because everybody in their house is going to need a car. You know, so the car dealers love it, and you know the car dealers support the Liberals. Is that the developers love it, and you know the developers support the Liberals. And imagine, I mean, they don't have, you see in the Vancouver Sun or in the Vancouver Province a transit reporter? They don't have a transit reporter, but they do have reporters that report on cars. They have a whole section on cars.
I've not seen that.
That's where the money comes from. That's where the money comes from.
It's so
do you think? The Vancouver Sun or the Vancouver Province are willing to support environmental issues when they know their bread is buttered with car dealers? You know, and so you get whole sections of the paper devoted to cars. Transit, all you get is criticism and no encouragement for the transit system. Is you get sections dealing with new house purchases in the Fraser Valley. So really what you've got is you've got a system in which the people who are passing comment on these things are so conflicted. They have no ability to be objective about it, because every time they're objective about it, they hurt their own interests economically. So we have to be more conscious. We have to be, you know, the conscience of what's occurring. We have to be out there and talking to each other about, is this the right choice? Now, I'm 56, you know, and this decision will probably not affect my life in any significant way. You know, it may be unpleasant for a little while, but it won't affect me. It will affect my kids and my grandkids, though. And it's going to affect every young person who's getting an education now. As you make this city unlivable, you know, as you make choices that are going to create pollution, that are going to create environmental damage, that are going to restrict your future decisions, that is critical. And I just wish there were more people who are standing up and helping us as we oppose the decision being made. You know, it's the wrong thing to do. We're on the right side of this argument, and we need support to be able to sustain it.
You're listening to Sustainable Futures on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is an interview with Mayor Derek Corrigan, the mayor of Burnaby.
Another thing that must affect Burnaby quite a lot is now that TransLink is privately owned. How do you feel about that?
It's, again, an appalling decision by the provincial government. The provincial government was extremely upset that the board of TransLink, who were elected politicians, mayors and councillors from around the Lower Mainland, when we opposed the Canada Line, the RAB line out to Richmond, we wanted to extend the Millennium Line out to Coquitlam Centre. We believed that we should support the growth concentration area, that it wasn't wise to build a rapid transit line as a first priority to an area in the floodplain and an area with heavy agricultural use. We didn't think that that was going to be a good decision. Much better to build to the northeast sector, to Coquitlam, Port Moody, Port Coquitlam, out to Maple Ridge, where you were going to have a significant growth concentration under our plan. So we opposed the government's view that it should go to Richmond. At that point, Kevin Falcon determined that we were all stupid and dysfunctional and began calling us names because we didn't agree with him. He started calling us names. He couldn't understand why we would dare suggest that the decision that was being imposed upon us wasn't the correct decision. And his view was, we control the money and the federal government controls the money, and if we want to build a line to Richmond, you bloody well accept it, and you do it with a smile on your face. And when we didn't, when we voted against it twice, he then said we were dysfunctional and we needed to go. So this is all about revenge. This is all about Kevin Falcon taking revenge on local politicians for having the temerity to oppose him. Kicking us out means that essentially we're being taxed on our property and we don't have any representation. You know, as the reality is that he's appointed a board of people that he knows will do what Kevin Falcon wants. And that board is now controlling your tax dollars, and you really have no access to that board. I can't even attend the board meetings, and I'm on the mayor's council. Is that I can't see what their decisions are or why their decisions are being made. So here you've got all of your tax dollars being paid, your transit fares being paid to this secretive little board who are going to run a happy little relationship with the provincial government utilizing local taxpayers' dollars. And it is beyond comprehension that this occurred. It shows you the arrogance of this government, having led in the polls for a significant period of time, is that they believe they can do anything they want. And taking over transit and handing it off to a board of their friends at $1,200 a meeting and $25,000 a year, that is something that, again, is accepted by the media, the dutiful media. You know, they applaud and say how the government is there. Highly concentrated, all of it coming from the same source, all of it right-wing. And the rest of us have these decisions imposed on us by the provincial government in which we lose our democratic rights. At some point, people are going to stand up. You know, I'm waiting for that, you know, for the other shoe to drop, for people to finally figure it out. You know, is that I think that probably, and this is true with young people again, is that I think they've always believed that their democratic rights were unassailable, that they were God-given, that nobody ever fought for those rights. You know, that it was simply given to them because they're so nice. When you take your rights and your democratic freedoms for granted, you'll pay a price. Eventually, you'll pay a price for it. Eventually, you're going to have to get them back. And when you do, there's going to be a price to be paid in getting them back. So I've opposed strenuously the takeover of TransLink by the provincial government. I've made noise in every possible way I can about it, but there hasn't been the reaction from the public that has truly challenged the government. They really do believe that they can do almost anything they want, and people will meekly accept it, that they'll do as they're told. And in many ways, I guess because people are so busy and they're so concerned about their own life and they're not willing to take the time to understand what's happening, the government is right. The provincial government has been successful in imposing their will. As a local politician, it takes a lot for local politicians to get together and stand up on these issues. You know, all of us have our own problems in our own municipality. The provincial government, notoriously, if you oppose what they do, they punish you. Doesn't matter whether you're Simon Fraser University or you're the city of Burnaby or you're any other organization. If you have the guts to stand up and say that's wrong, provincial government punishes you. They refuse to give you any grants. They take away money. They do whatever they do in order to make sure that you understand who's boss.
Right. It's sort of a bullying.
Constant bullying. In fact, recently I was on the show with Christy Clark, who has now been cleansed of her Liberal government connections, you know, because she's on CKNW and a member of the media now, is that suddenly she's become objective. But I was on the show with her the other day because she's now on this cause of bullying. And I said, you know, you've spent weeks on bullying. Maybe you can give me some advice on how to deal with Kevin Falcon, because the man is just a complete bully. And it seems that Campbell is quite prepared to have this bully boy out there throwing his weight around and against municipalities or anyone else who dares oppose him. You know, so I think, again, is that until they begin to see a difference in the polls, until they see a reaction, until people start saying, you're making bad choices for our society, there isn't going to be much change made. And those of us who are fighting the good fight, local politicians. By the way, you know, the vast majority of local politicians are not NDP, right? The vast majority, I'm a New Democrat. Daryl Masato, the mayor of North Van City, is a New Democrat. That's about it for the New Democrats that are mayors. So, you know, you're looking at people who are not coming from an opposition point of view, who are the ones who are voting against these decisions. Is it Vancouver is controlled by the MPA. Sam Sullivan, Peter Ladner, Suzanne Anton, the whole group of them voted against the Gateway Project. You know, do you think they were doing that just to make the government mad or just to oppose the government? They were doing it because it was wrong. You know, because it's the wrong choice. Yeah. That they cannot countenance the wrong choice being made. So, you know, the reality is that it doesn't matter what your politics are. It's when things are going wrong, you have to stand up and say so. The problem we've got in our society, I guess, at this point is that there aren't enough people that are prepared to stand up. And with the media that's entirely controlled by, you know, economic interests and is so closely held by a small group of people, that media doesn't report effectively on any of the things that are happening. And what you have to depend on is local radio stations like Simon Fraser Station to take up these issues and let somebody have the time and, and talk to them about the issue.
There seems to be a common theme going on, and I think that people feel powerless when actually they are the most powerful when they get together.
Well, that's right. And when you think back to the time when I was a young man, you know, we were fighting against what we believe were significant wrongs in the world. And by fighting against those issues, we did make a difference. You know, is that the Vietnam War stopped because young people, both in the U.S. but in Canada too, were not prepared to countenance it. They were prepared to come out and they were standing up for each other and for what they believed should be the view of their society. And they eventually defeated that war and changed the way people perceived those problems. You know, is that much of what's happened as far as the choices we've made in the last generations, including decisions like the Agricultural Land Reserve, came because young people were demanding that we protect the things that were important to us, the values. The Agricultural Land Reserve responded to young people saying, we believe that protecting our farmland is crucial to our future. And we were right. You know, we were right to end war. We were right to protect farmland. You know, we believed that we could make a difference in the world by creating better educational opportunities. Young people like me only got to university from a single-parent family because university was inexpensive. Because there were decent jobs in the summer, I could go to work in the summer, and I could go to university because university was inexpensive. Now, university is being priced beyond the realm of aspirations for young people. Is that now full-time attendance at university is almost impossible for someone of modest means to accomplish. Is that you're able to take a few courses and work part-time while you're going. And most of those jobs are being paid at $8 an hour. You know, so you're not given the opportunities to be able to make a decent income and to get the education that you want, struggle and you fight, and people are accepting it. That's what astounds me, is that education should be open to everyone. In a knowledge-based society, in a society that wants to make progress in the world, there is lots of labor out there in the world. Is our objective in Canada is to create knowledge, is to be in a position where we're utilizing our assets, our education system, to produce people who can help teach the rest of the world. And we're losing that. We're not getting the opportunity. We're not recognizing the potential. Young people are coming out of university with such massive debt that they spend years trying to crawl out of the hole they've dug for themselves as a result of the finances. That's unreasonable. Education should be available to everyone. And that in a healthy society, we should look at two fundamental issues as being equal opportunity. That's to have good health and to have a good education. And then you make what you will of it. You're challenged then to say, if you've got good health, you've got a good education. If you fail or you don't succeed, that's your fault. You know, but if you're never given the opportunity, if you're never given the health to be able to do it, and you're never given the education to do it, it's our fault as a society. And I think we did in the generation that I come from, we fought very hard and adamantly to keep tuitions low, to make university and college and any kind of secondary education available to everyone. There's issues that all of us have to take on, and you know, I wish that more young people were stepping up to the plate on these things, because they are the voice that's going to make a difference. When it comes to these elections, if young people come out, if they step up to the plate, if they come out and influence opinions, they can influence their parents' opinions, for God's sake, about mm-hmm. these issues. Parents will listen to someone young who says, this is my world. I'm going to inherit this world. What I want is for you to vote to be able to give me a better world. That's influential on parents. I know when my kids talk to me about those issues, I listen very carefully, because I know that is the truth, is that everything I've done in my life, I do for them. And so the reality of how this world is going to be in the future and what they need to accomplish is a very important part of my life too. We need to take responsibility, and you know, too often what I get from the young people, and I work with a lot of young people in my job, is I get this sense of frustration. It's all bigger than me. What can I do? You know, is it, how can I deal with this? I know you're right, but I've got too many responsibilities on my shoulders. I've got to work. I've got to do my school. I've got to have a social life. I've got to, you know, these things are all things I need to do. And really, you know, what I say is the first priority is to be responsible, is to come out and understand that it's your world, and if you don't act, if you don't become political, if you don't make the choices, is what you're going to inherit isn't what you want.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Derek. This has been Derek Corrigan, the mayor of Burnaby, and this is Sustainable Futures. I'm Ryan Fletcher. Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to Sustainable Futures on CJSF 90.1 FM. That concludes our two-part interview with Mayor Derek Corrigan, the mayor of Burnaby, British Columbia. Ryan, he had a lot of really interesting things to say today.
Yeah, he's a very active person, and it's so politically active and interested in youth involvement. I found that to be such a great experience, to go and interview him and to find someone in politics that's very interested in young people.
And the environment.
And the environment, yes. So I hope you the listeners, have also found this to be really refreshing. I find him to be a really refreshing voice.
Definitely.
So coming up on the second half of the show, we have Maya Green, and she'll be talking about fun camps, Friends Uniting for Nature. So this is summer camps for youth ages 11 to 15. So, Kimberly, how did this interview come about for you?
Well, I actually heard about fun camps from Green Drinks, a monthly event for environmental professionals, or really anybody who's interested in sustainability and the environment. It's a networking event, a time to kind of meet new people and get together and talk about the environment and sustainability. So I actually heard about it from there. She was there, and she had some brochures there, so I thought that this is a wonderful opportunity for youth to learn more about sustainability. And I thought that it was a really unique idea as well, because it not only just teaches youth about sustainability and the environment, but it also teaches them leadership and mm-hmm. how to actually go about teaching others about this, and therefore, you know, kind of creating this momentum with leadership and sustainability and all of that sort of good stuff. So I thought that it was a really great opportunity to talk to somebody doing something cool for the environment.
Here we have Maya Green.
You've been working in the environmental area for quite a long time. Can you give me a little bit of your history in the environmental area?
Sure. to make it brief, it started, I'd say, back when I was about 6 or 7, and then I tried to launch my first international, like, green club when I lived overseas, and I was about 9, and that sort of set off my world of trying to organize environmental projects. And then from there, sort of the main ones I did throughout high school was started a big creek cleanup and rubber ducky race that happened every year, and then I did an environmental studies degree at UVic and did various other projects, and have sort of since then, and now this is sort of my new sort of biggest, most significant project.
How did fun camps come about, and I guess what was the inspiration behind that, besides your love for the environment?
Well, I guess it was the combination of my love for the environment and my love for working with kids, and really just feeling that education is like the most significant way to make change, and that when people are educated and kind of understand, first of all, that they can make a difference and they're not helpless, and also that they need to, the combination can be quite powerful and empowering, and people do sort of change. And I think that's the way towards getting policy change and all these other sort of bigger things. I think it all starts with education. And so I had looked into environmental summer camps, and there was not really such a thing. And so when I came to Vancouver, I was looking for meaningful work, and it just happened to be the right time to try and start it. And I came across a couple other summer camps that were focused on sort of environmental stewardship issues, but not specifically on leadership and not specifically on sort of how to be sustainable in your day-to-day life, which is what I wanted to focus on.
So leadership is a main goal of the summer camps. What are some of the goals?
Well, it started with three main pillars: sustainability, leadership, and collaboration. The idea with those was that sustainability would be to create, you know, more education in the world of sustainability. The leadership side of things was to create leaders so that they'd have the leadership skills and tools to actually take their education, pass it on to other people, and create sort of an environmental education domino effect. And then the collaboration side of things was just the fact that we're all working towards the same goal, that NGOs should all be sort of working together, not reinventing the wheel, not recreating things that have been done over and over. So I wanted to work with as many environmental groups as possible to kind of collaborate their curriculum materials to create sort of a, you know, best of type of curriculum for the camps, and also get as many people sort of behind me and supporting me as possible, and in return sort of do the same for them. So to just kind of foster a feeling of collaboration and teach that within the camps as well, because I think that that's how we're going to get places, not through competition.
They are week-long camps for youth. What kind of activities will the campers be doing to, you know, meet those goals or to achieve those goals?
Well, there's going to be obviously a wide variety of things, especially because it does range from environmental education to leadership. So there will be specific leadership skill workshops and stuff. Like, one of the head trainers at Lululemon is actually going to be coming up and doing an hour-long workshop every week for the kids on the first day to really get them inspired and invigorated about the leadership side of things. Bikes on the Drive is going to be coming up once a week to do bike safety and maintenance workshops to promote, you know, bicycling as a alternative mode of transportation that's fun and efficient. We're going to be doing hikes in North Van. We're going to be doing exercises and games focusing around climate change. There's going to be Al Gore climate change trained presenters coming every week. There's all sorts of great people volunteering their time once a week for different workshops. And then my staff are going to be doing all of the games and activities and sports and things in between. And all of them will be to a certain theme. So there's five themes, one for each day of the week. So it will go energy, water, transportation, food, and community. And the last day will sort of be about how important it is to actually have community and a sense of community to reach sustainability. We can't do it all.
No, definitely not.
And a lot of the other things are tied into those things, right? So climate change really involves all those things. I mean, to reach the climate change goals, we need to make changes in all of those different aspects of our life. So we'll be sort of incorporating climate change and that type of stuff throughout the programming.
What is the importance of educating youth on environmental issues?
Well, I think, like I said before, just empowering them to actually make a difference and make a change. And I think that I really think education is the key to all positive change in the world. And that might be kind of a naive statement, but when my friend and I sort of initially started brainstorming and talking about this, we really said, like, education is the key to everything. It's like the most important thing. And by educating youth, first of all, in the short term, youth are so passionate and they get so much done. And some of the stories I see of what youth are doing for the environment is just so unbelievably inspiring. And to be able to create more people who are able and wanting to do that is, I think, seems like a really good goal. And they have so much energy and so much drive, and people listen to them, and they can be really good advocates for positive change. And also, it's their future. So they need to not do what we've done. And they're going to be living in a completely different world, whether they like it or not. So they need to know what they can do, and that small changes and big changes can make a world that's going to be much more functional and sustainable in the long term for themselves. And I think the goal of all leaders is not to create a bunch of followers, but to create a bunch of other leaders. And so as someone who's sort of been, I guess, a leader in the environmental movement and always started my own projects, I want to create a bunch of mini-me's. I want to inspire, like, our tagline is to inspire youth into action. So we can't give them every piece of information and education, but we can inspire them into caring about the natural world, seeing the importance of why a sustainable, healthy community is a good thing to have, and give them the tools to sort of achieve that.
Working with youth these days, how is the environmental message received by them?
I was just last week at See the Sky Outdoor School, which is one of the most amazing places I've ever been. It's on Keats Island. It's a completely sustainable education school where school groups go. And that was one of the most inspiring times I've ever had, because just seeing some of these kids have never, ever been in nature, which to me is completely, completely foreign. I mean, I'm so thankful to my family and to my privileged life that that hasn't been the case for me, and I've spent tons of time in nature. But, you know, I showed this kid his first hermit crab and put it on his hand, and, like, you know, he was very slow to warm up to it, but it was really neat. And overall, I think the kids really saw the importance of it. They really did get it. These were grade 6 kids. You know, once you start getting older, it's not really that cool anymore, and that really needs to change too, which is part of the point of having just like this fun, sporty, artsy camp that is for all types. It's not about being like a nature geek or something. Like, it's really not about that anymore, but it still has a bit of that stigma. And that, I think, really needs to change, because once you get into high school, it kind of, you get put in a category. And I don't think the environment should be a hobby where people like music or they like the environment. Like, the environment needs to be an underlying thing in everybody's life. And I think all aspects of education eventually. From all the kids I've ever worked with, it's always very well received by them.
What are some of the challenges that you encounter while educating youth about the environment?
I guess, you know, making sure, like, you want to keep it really fun and really light, but you also want them to see how serious it is, because you do want them to have that take-home message. Like, your ultimate goal is that they're going to make changes in their own life, and that it's going to stick with them for their life, and that they'll also inspire their parents into making some of these changes. You don't want to make it too serious, because you want to keep it really fun, but at the same time, you don't want them to just be joking about it. And often, like, you know, they're kids, right? They're always playful and having fun and stuff, and so you'll do something really serious, and then 15 minutes later, they're totally joking about it and making a big sort of thing. I don't find that there's too many challenges. They seem really receptive. You know, like I said, there's the kids who have never been in nature, and that's a challenge if you're taking them on a hike and that sort of thing. Some of them just haven't been exposed to that kind of stuff, and they don't feel comfortable. Usually that's one of the most empowering moments of a leader, because usually you get really amazing results from those kids. Those are the surprising, inspiring ones.
What have you found to be the most effective way to educate people about sustainability? Are there any kind of techniques or approaches that, you know, the way that you present things to people or to youth about mm-hmm. the environment?
I think the term would be experiential learning, and it's the idea of actually having kids experience it. And so something like See the Sky Outdoor School does that beautifully, because what they do is they flip this statistic, which is that we spend, 94% of our waking hours we spend inside, the average, I don't know, North American or Canadian or something. And they flip that upside down. So they spend 94% of their waking hours when they're at See the Sky Outdoor School outside. So all curriculum's given outside. The only time they're ever inside is to sit down and eat. And then when it gets warm enough, they're outside for that too. I mean, that's just one example. But in terms of doing it in the city, like, we're fortunate enough, we're up at UBC. We're going to have nature time every day in the Pacific Spirit Park. There's going to be sort of solitude time where kids sit and they journal and they reflect and they sort of have these moments in beautiful spots in nature, go on hikes, and actually do hands-on stuff, and spend as much time outside as possible, and just make it as fun and exciting and interesting as possible, and sort of as far from dry textbook classroom learning as possible. Incorporating in song and, like, songs and drama and costumes, and making it just different and fun and something that they're really just enjoying, I think is the best way to sort of get through.
When do the camps start?
They start July 7th, and they're a week long each, so they go for 8 weeks, starting from that point.
And these are for youth ages 11 to 15?
Yeah.
Are there all different ages within 1 week, or mm-hmm. are they divided up per sort of age group within that age?
No, within the 11 to 15 age group, the idea is that because it's a leadership-focused camp, older kids can take on slightly more leadership roles, and get to actually practice the leadership side of things and almost be like mentors to some of the younger kids. It is a big age split, but at the same time, most of the camps I've ever done have been like 6 to 12 or 5 to 12 or, you know, those camps that are 12 to 18. Like, you can put any different sort of groups of age together and make it work. And for certain activities, like, definitely we'll probably split up into ages for an hour here, an hour there. One group will go with one leader, one group will go with the other. But mostly the goal is to work together and feed off of each other. How much does it cost? It's $185 for a week. And fortunately, we just actually got a grant from the Climate Action Secretariat, and we have a bunch of funding to put towards scholarships for youth with low incomes. So I'm hopefully going to be working with the Boys and Girls Club and some of the youth programmers from around town, because we now have at least two free spots per week. And people can, like individuals as well, can sponsor a child. So I've had a few people sort of responding to my newsletter saying they're willing to sponsor a child. So I now have even a few more scholarship spots, which is great. So those kids will be able to come free of charge.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So if somebody wanted to sponsor a student, how would they go about doing that?
Probably the easiest way is to just go to our website and contact me.
Are there any other ways for groups, other nonprofit groups or organizations or businesses or just individuals to help you or get involved?
There's an assortment of ways. We always need help, especially because it's a pilot project year. We're always looking for good volunteers, either to help before or after the program, as well as during the program. And there's all sorts of different volunteer positions available. Businesses, we're always looking to, if they would like to support financially, be a sponsor, in-kind donations for supplies for the camps, or sponsoring students. And same for individuals, like if a group of people from an office want to sponsor a child together or something, there's always an option for that. And any sort of collaboration in terms of curriculum and offering support in terms of outreach or curriculum, anything in terms of that, we've had people supporting us in all sorts of different ways. It's been really neat.
Well, thanks so much, Maya, for meeting with me today and to talk about the fun camps. And if you do want to register, you can check out the website.
www.funcamps.ca.
So that was a really interesting interview. I'm really happy to know that there's things set up for youth in sustainability, especially locally.
Yeah.
It was a really great interview.
It was. And Maya is so inspiring because she's got so much energy and she loves doing what she does. She loves working with youth. And as she said in the interview, she wants to create tons and tons of mini-me's so that there can be lots of other people in the future working towards a more sustainable future and doing some good things for the environment.
Yeah, that's really key to the future is the youth, of course. And what a great idea. I'm really happy, really, really happy to see that this dilemma is being put forward to them early. Obviously, their life is going to be very much attached to this.
I think their lives are going to be very different than the lives that you and I have known up until this point in time. So it is great. And of course, being that today is July the 18th, Fun Camps has started. And from what I hear, it has really just taken off. There's so much interest in Fun Camps. Spaces are filling up. Lots of parents are saying, get my kid in there. And lots of people are saying, here's some money. Sponsor somebody to come to these camps for me. So there's tons of interest. So if you do want to sponsor somebody, or if you want your own children or child to be a part of this amazing experience, check out their website. It's www.funcamps.ca.
And now our streeters this week
are from Fun Camps.
Yeah.
Very fitting. I really wanted to hear what the youth going to these camps thought about what they were learning. And I got
Were they having fun?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which they definitely are. They're having a ton of fun. They're learning about a number of different environmental issues. So I wanted to find out what they thought about sustainability and where they wanted to see the world in 10 to 15 years when they're our age, Ryan.
Oh, yes. Okay. So let's hear what they had to say with our weekly streeters.
Black to blue. You mess with us, we mess with you. From the east to the west. Camp Fun is the best. Go Jellyfish!
I'm here at Fun Camps today, here at the UBC campus. What's your name?
I'm Betty.
What do you think about nature?
It's very important to us.
What do you think the biggest problem is on Earth today?
Pollution and global warming.
How do you think that we can solve some of those problems?
I think people should drive less cars, and then they can walk and ride their bikes to work. It's a good exercise and it also helps the environment.
What do you think the one thing that people can do every day to save the environment?
Don't use so much electronic stuff.
Where would you like to see the world in the future?
A more naturey place, and I want to see like trees everywhere and people being happy.
What's your favorite thing that you've learned so far at the camps?
I like every part of the camp, and my favorite part is making a solo car.
What's your name?
Daily.
What has been your favorite part about the camp so far?
Making the t-shirts, making the solar paneled cars, and being able to race them to see how fast they go.
And do they actually go fast?
Yes, kind of. Well, like kind of went the same speed you can walk, but just a bit slower.
What do you think the most important thing that people can do for the environment is?
Not pollute, not litter, walk or bicycle everywhere. Use fluorescent lights instead of like normal light bulbs because they last a lot longer.
Where would you like to see the world in the future when you grow up?
Maybe I would like vast roads, a whole bunch of trees with like a few buildings. I want kind of like a countryside where it's like nice and where everybody walks or bicycles or runs or jogs, and have it where like not everybody litters and there's like garbage cans that are painted very beautifully colored with lots of colorful like decorations and flowers and everything. And I want it sunny.
What is the most challenging problem that we face in the world today?
Global warming, child labor, and yeah.
Thanks so much, Daily. Awesome. Bye. What's your name?
I'm Abigail.
Are you enjoying the camp so far?
Yeah, it's really fun.
What kinds of things are you learning here?
A lot about the environment and recycling and how to reduce waste and things like that.
What's your favorite part of the camp so far?
Probably making the solar power cars. That was really fun. And it was so cool how, like, as soon as they reached shade, they stopped. And then as soon as you put them back in sun, they started moving again. It was really fun building them.
What do you think is the biggest problem facing the world today?
Probably global warming, with the garbage that doesn't need to be there. Like, so a lot of it can be recycled and composted and stuff. So there's a lot more garbage than there needs to be.
What can everybody do in their daily lives to make the world a better place?
Definitely recycle and compost, and not just think of the world as something they own. Like, treat it with respect, like they would themselves.
Where would you like to see the world in the future when you grow up?
Definitely more, less cars and a lot more bikes and scooters and rollerblades and things like that. And also not as big, construction, making so much pollution and stuff, maybe smaller houses.
And what do you want to be when you grow up?
Something to do with animals, because I really like animals.
What's your name?
Steven.
Steven, what is your favorite part of the fun camp so far?
So far, I like going out to the forest and get to relax and see nature.
What do you think the biggest problem facing the world is today?
I think it's... Could it be more than one?
It can be more than one.
I think one of them is the pollution, which makes global warming. And then also people are very greedy for money and they're not caring about other people and they're destroying nature.
Why do you think it's important to have a healthy environment?
Because then we'll have a happier life, and then the generations after could see how nature is wonderful and all those creatures.
What's your favorite part about nature?
I guess it's the animals. I like seeing them running around, enjoying their own time. Yeah.
What do you think is the easiest thing that people can do to make the world a better place?
I think donating to the third world countries, that would be a very easy job. Since there's so many people, then they could just give a little and all combined could be very much help for the third world countries.
Where would you like to see the world in the future?
I like to see the world in a better place without having so much pollution and people won't have sorrow on their faces and they will be happy.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
I haven't really decided yet since there's so many things to choose from. But then maybe I'll be a soccer player because I like soccer myself.
We're number one, not two, not three, not four. We're gonna win, not lose, not tie the score. We're number one. Go Perfect Panthers!
Yay. Awesome! And now for this week's environmental news.
The Ontario provincial government has committed to protecting a large portion of its northern boreal forest. 43% of Ontario's landmass consists of the boreal forest, and the government plans to protect at least 225,000 square kilometers of it. Canada's boreal region is an important carbon sink, and the Ontario portion of the forest absorbs approximately 12.5 million tons of CO2 every year. Ontario's boreal region is also home to over 200 sensitive species of animals. By protecting such a large portion of the boreal forest, Ontario hopes to preserve the region's biodiversity and support the fight against climate change. The BC Games torch will be snuffed out this summer to give the environment a break. The torch will no longer burn throughout the Games in order to conserve natural gas and prevent emissions from escaping into the atmosphere. The BC Games Society made the decision to douse the torch in light of the growing sense of environmental awareness. The torch will still be ablaze during the opening and closing ceremonies. According to the Bible, God created the earth in 6 days and rested on the seventh. But instead of rest, Pope Benedict is calling Catholic youth to action. At this year's World Youth Day in Sydney, Australia, Pope Benedict encouraged Catholic youth to care for the planet. During his address on Thursday, the 81-year-old Pope described the Earth as squandered and scarred, and asked his audience to protect the Earth for future generations. And the pain associated with kidney stones has been referred to as the closest men will ever get to experiencing the pain of childbirth. And men are also more likely to get kidney stones than women. So if this is the case, men, you'd better be prepared. Researchers from the University of Texas have identified a correlation between rising temperatures and a rise in the rate of kidney stones. The researchers predict that the prevalence of kidney stones will increase along with global warming. The development of kidney stones is influenced by environmental factors such as temperature. Currently, kidney stone disease has a marked presence in what can be referred to as the kidney stone belt of the southeastern United States. As temperatures increase, this area is predicted to move northward and westward, and closer to Canada.
So that wraps it up for this week's episode of Sustainable Futures. It's been really nice to have one centered around youth.
Definitely. But next week's show is going to be awesome too, Ryan, isn't it?
We've got a great interview with Catherine Collette, who was involved in the Green Party of Canada in its very, very early days. She was actually the leader, which is significant also because she's female, and she's one of the first female political leaders, as well as one of the first leaders of the Green Party, and also talked about Global Warming Cafe.
So be sure to tune in next week. For Sustainable Futures, I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher, and we are wishing you
a sustainable future. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. We are also available on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. And if you want any information, you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.